1971, would seem to be that our warning assessment, attack assessment, and damage assessment capabilities are so limited that the president may well have to make PSYOP execution decisions virtually in the blind, at least so far as real-time information is concerned. A few years later, another top-secret report said that the American response to a nuclear attack would be imperfect, poorly coordinated, and largely uncontrolled, with confused and frightened men making decisions where their authority to do so was questionable, and the consequences staggeringly large. As the Soviet Union added multiple warheads to its ballistic missiles, Pentagon officials began to worry about the vulnerability of America's nuclear forces. A Soviet surprise attack might wipe out not only the nation's command and control facilities, but also its land-based missiles. To deter such an attack, the Strategic Air Command considered a new retaliatory option known as Launch on Warning or Launch Under Attack. As soon as a Soviet attack was detected, and before a single warhead detonated, the United States would launch its land-based missiles, saving them from destruction. A launch on warning policy might dissuade the Kremlin from attempting a surprise attack, but it would also place enormous demands on America's command and control system. Missiles launched from Soviet submarines could hit Minuteman and Titan II bases in the central United States within about 15 minutes. Missiles launched from the Soviet Union would arrive in about half an hour. The president would have no more than 20 minutes to decide whether to retaliate, and would probably have a lot less time than that. With each passing minute, the pressure to use it or lose it would grow stronger, and the time constraints would increase the risk of errors. The reliability of America's early warning system attained an existential importance. If the sensors failed to detect a Soviet attack, the order to launch might never be given. But if they issued an attack warning erroneously, millions of people would be killed by mistake. The Pentagon decision to provide the United States with a nuclear hair trigger capable of being fired at a moment's notice oddly coincided with the warmest relations between the two superpowers since the end of the Second World War. The Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968 hadn't raised tensions between the two Germanies, inspired massive demonstrations against the Soviet Union, or provoked much European revulsion toward communism. On the contrary, the overthrow of a moderate Czech government had encouraged Willy Brandt, the foreign minister of West Germany at the time, to seek closer ties with the Soviet Union. The status quo in Europe, the division between East and West, would not be challenged. Within a few years, a series of international agreements clarified the legal status of Berlin, recognized the sovereignty of both German governments, promised to reduce the threat of nuclear war, and established a working relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union known as détente. The two countries signed the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, allowing each side to defend two locations from attack. The Threshold Test Ban Treaty, limiting the size of underground detonations to 150 kilotons, and an interim agreement on certain measures with respect to the limitation of strategic offensive arms, freezing the number of land-based ballistic missiles and permitting the deployment of new submarine-based missiles only when old ones were retired. The advent of détente did not, however, end the nuclear arms race. The United States and the Soviet Union continued to modernize weapon systems and improve their accuracy. More than ever, nuclear weapons seemed important as totems of status and world power. Not long after taking office, President Nixon tried to end the Vietnam War by threatening the use of nuclear weapons, convinced that Eisenhower had employed a similar tactic to end the war in Korea. "I call it the madman theory, Bob," Nixon told his chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman. "I want the North Vietnamese to believe that I've reached the point where I might do anything to stop the war." The Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff thought it was a bad idea. But Nixon and Kissinger thought the plan might work. Ignoring the safety risks, the Strategic Air Command secretly resumed its airborne alert for 2 weeks. B-52s loaded with hydrogen bombs took off from bases in the United States and flew circular routes along the coast of the Soviet Union. Neither the Soviets nor the Viet Cong was fooled by the bluff. A few years later, at the height of the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, nuclear weapons were once again utilized as a diplomatic tool. Concerned that the Soviet Union might send troops to Egypt, Secretary of State Kissinger and Secretary of Defense James R. Schlesinger placed American military forces throughout the world at DEFCON 3. The elevated level of readiness was a signal to the Soviet Union, implying that the United States was willing to fight a nuclear war over the issue. The Soviets didn't intervene in the Mideast conflict, and Kissinger later attributed their reluctance to the administration's bold diplomacy. Great leaders sometimes need to appear unbalanced, he thought. What seems balanced and safe in a crisis is often the most risky. Fred Eakley served as the head of the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency during the Nixon and Ford administrations. Eakley brought to the job an extensive knowledge of nuclear weapons, deterrence theory, and the workings of the command and control system. He argued against the adoption of a launch-on-warning policy, worried that it could inadvertently prove to be disastrous. Nevertheless, the policy had a strong military and psychological appeal. Launching the ICBM force on attack assessment is probably the simplest and most cost-effective way to frustrate a Soviet counterforce attack, a classified RAND report noted. But as a declared policy, we believe it would be vigorously opposed as both dangerous and unstable. An accident could theoretically precipitate a nuclear war. At a meeting of the National Security Council, Eakley expressed his opposition to launch-on-warning, calling it accident-prone. Secretary of State Kissinger disagreed, praising its usefulness as a deterrent. Kissinger felt confident that the command and control system could handle it, and stressed that the Soviets must never be able to calculate that you plan to rule out such an attack. The National Security Advisor, Brent Scowcroft, agreed with Kissinger. Reason now played a diminished role in nuclear strategy. It is not to our disadvantage, Scowcroft said, if we appear irrational to the Soviets in this regard. Too much madness, however, could be dangerous. Since the days of Harry Truman, the President of the United States had been entrusted with the sole authority to order the use of nuclear weapons.